Yo, what up? Salutations, bienvenue, Jumbo, all in your mind, really going down, all of that. Welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Train podcast series. I am Joseph Ward, he is Patrick Irvin, and we've been podcasting since 2014. The Freedom Train podcast series is brought to you by PAX Inc., that's PACTSINC. Make sure you check out the website at paxinc.org, PACTSINC.org. A lot of great information, a lot of great resources for you and your family, especially if you're trying to learn more about Black history. Forget that critical race theory stuff. Go to PAX Inc. And PAX Inc. will link you to other websites that got a whole lot more information, like On the Shoulders of Giants, ontheshoulders1.com. Make sure you check it out. Also, check out support PAX Inc. through the Amazon Smile program. So go to AmazonSmile.com, register, and when you register, you get to pick a nonprofit organization you want to support. Pick PAX Inc. Bam. Every time you buy something, a portion of your proceeds will support PAX Inc. and any other organization you choose to support, but support PAX Inc. PACTSINC.org. www.freedomtrainradio.com is the website. We're on Google Podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Radio Public, Stitcher, iHeart, all of them, we're rounding out our mental health awareness month. You know, it's important for us to make sure we make this month happen and give reasonable, factual information that you can go and look up yourself and practically use. The psychological effects of slavery overall. But we're going to break that down into different parts. So looking at the overall psychological effects of slavery, and we are going to be using some resources from Dr. Naeem Akbar, and especially his book, what I recommend that you all read, Breaking the Psychological Chains of Slavery by Dr. Naeem Akbar. So using some of his information plus other information that we've researched, but breaking down the psychological effects of slavery over the areas of overall health, mental health, poverty and racism, intergenerational cultural trauma, terror management theory, in conjunction with post-traumatic slave syndrome. So put your seatbelt on, put your pen and your pad out, put your hard hat on, put your headband on, put your bonnet on, your Gucci slippers, contacts, whatever you need. Make sure you bathe. We don't want no non-bathers. Make sure you bathe. And let's do this. Let's keep this thing in the gear. You see Pat showing y'all his eyes. He bathing. There it is. So when you hear the psychological effects of slavery, what are some of the thoughts that come to your mind when you hear somebody say, well, what is the psychological effects of slavery? Or are you just in general somebody talking about it?
Absent the context, I think about a lot of things. You know what I'm saying? I think about trauma. I think about learned helplessness. I think about low self-esteem, overcompensation, trust issues, relationship development issues. I think about a lot of things when I hear that. What do you think about, Joseph A. Ward?
Behavior. The first thing that comes to my mind is behavior overall. Well, individual behavior as well as group behavior. And I think about how we treat ourselves and I think about how we treat others. But I also I think about the Willie Lynch letter, but not in the sense of is it true or is it not true, but looking at the way behavior of African American behavior was shaped and modified throughout the millennia. And also how racism can adapt and be able to transform itself to still be present and still be dominant in our minds, in our total beings, as long as we are ignorant of what's truly happening to us. And that's the other part that I think about is how a great number of us don't really understand what has happened to us. Because you know how people are always asking, well, why are we like this and why are we like this? But not understanding, you know, there are causes to that. We're not supposed to behave like any other group of people because what happened to us didn't happen to any other group of people. We were enslaved by some savages who brutally beat us, brutally worked us, raped us, verbally demeaned us, economically suppressed us. Any way they can terrorize us, they terrorized us, and they terrorized us for over 400 years. So, you know, I'm always asking the question, if it took 400 to 500 years to shape our minds to the way it is now, how long will it take to undo that? Now, do I know if it'll take 400 or 500 years? I don't know. But that is the question. How long will it take to undo the mental screwing that has happened to us from all the trauma and the terror that we, our ancestors experienced over a 400 to 500 year period?
I like that question. My view of it is, how long will it take before we can live with it and progress? Because I don't think it can be undone. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, we can't go back to the way we were. The experience is a part of us now. You know, it's shaped us. It's molded us. Even if we went through some sort of magical therapy, absent of erasing the experience from us, both psychologically and genetically, it's going to be there shaping us. So how do we get to a point to where it's no longer negatively impacting our current existence and our current behaviors and our current relationships? And it's still a good question.
But that's a good addition to it, though. See, that's why we bring our minds together, because that's a great addition to what I asked. Because I think both questions are very important. How long does it take to undo it? But also, in the midst of undoing it, how long does it take to be able to live with it and progress?
Right.
Because that's the key point. Not just living with it, but living with it and progressing.
Got to progress. Progression is the goal.
Right. And progress doesn't mean just individual progress within the white world. We mean a collective progress in the black world. With us doing this.
Right. Right. Well, it's like the kind, I don't know if you guys saw it, but if you did not, on the show to the Giants a couple months ago, maybe longer, we did a show where we talked about black progress versus white progress. And when we're talking about progress, every time I speak about progress and I don't clarify, I'm talking about black people progressing, like doing things that allow us to acquire power and authority to manifest our own destinies, to manifest whatever we want to manifest.
Real sex, real straight up self-actualization.
Absolutely. So, and the goal for me is to get to a place where the trauma that we've experienced culturally, which has not been erased. And even if you want to say it doesn't matter or it doesn't affect you, that's fine. But we're not talking about individuals when we have these conversations. We're talking about culture groups. We're talking about the collective. And the collective is still being affected. That's an entirely different discussion. And we have numbers and statistics to show that the black community is still being impacted by racism. So how do we get to a point to where we accept as a collective that racism, white supremacy still exists? And then how do we move past that point of acceptance into a point of actually doing things to progress about it?
Right.
Because right now, I think we're stuck at accepting. I think most black people accept that it's existed.
I say there are a good bit that accept, but there's a good bit that don't want to accept.
I think that number is growing only because there's been no progress to the next step. And you know, without progression, there's regression.
And this article is citing Dr. Naeem Akbar. So it's saying, they're basically saying Dr. Naeem Akbar maintained the social and psychological impact of enslavement persisted across generations and still affects the African-American personality, and that contemporary Black Americans have inherited an extensive list of dysfunctional attitudes, habits, and behaviors from the era of enslavement. Consistent with this view, the emerging field of epigenetics,
gene expression, that are environmental factors coded into genes and how they're expressed, is passed down from generation to generation. Right. Genetic memory.
But basically, the emerging field of epigenetics proposes that the effects of environmental challenges faced by a parent may be displayed by offspring despite the children not encountering the same challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of set the tone. So, and then get back into our overall health. So understanding physically, mentally, psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, all the areas of human activity, we've been oppressed, suppressed, depressed, and repressed. So now let's look at our overall health. We know Black America lead the nation in health disparities, especially down yonder in the Bible Belt.
In the Bible Belt.
If you're down yonder in the Bible Belt, we lead the, I feel like, and it's probably wrong, but I feel like we lead the world in disparities, but we definitely, the Bible Belt definitely leads the country in disparities. And we know a good number of Black people do live in the South, but even just spread out throughout the United States, our overall health isn't the greatest. Mm-hmm. And some of that, a lot of that is attributed to what we still eat. And we know that's coming over from slavery, because they gave us the leftovers, the scraps. And we still eat some of those. We still eat a lot of those things today, but our overall health isn't great. But just so let's think about psychologically what happened to us and how is that contributing to our health?
Like I said, we talk about epigenetics all the time. We rarely use that term.
Right.
But we do talk about it quite often. I've read numerous books on epigenetics. I think the field is fascinating because of the implications of it, especially as it, pertains to Black people and dealing with the psychological stress of the argument that's constantly and consistently, pushed forward in America, which says slavery didn't happen to you. You weren't affected by it. That's one of the reasons why I got into studying up on epigenetics, is because I was like, here's the science that says that I was affected by it, and those changes are expressed. Decisions that your grandfather made are expressed in you. Decisions that your great-grandmother made are expressed in you and how you view the world and how you interact with the world. And then even to the food point you just made, we still eat that food. We're still groomed to think that that food is delicious. And I'm not going up front. I'm no different than any other Black person. I think the food is delicious as well. The problem is that food is high in caloric value and low in nutritional value. And it was okay in a time period where you were working a lot and you could burn all that off.
Yeah, but now we're so sedentary.
Right, now we're so sedentary. So it requires a change in the way we think about and process the world. But we're not necessarily capable of making that change because the trauma keeps us locked in to this position of not being able to make an adjustment.
But also, in looking at overall health, factoring in environmental health, and when we're talking about environmental health,
you got to be careful here.
Well, environment, the environments we live in, because we're talking about environmental health, well, the earth, the our ecosystem around us, also the social and cultural system around us, the encounters with police, incarceration rates, racism we face on a regular basis, murder, just crime and poverty, drugs. Like, so, because we're talking about intergenerational trauma as well. So trauma that began in the 1600s, but has been reinforced on a daily basis for over 500 years. It's still trauma that's still being reinforced environmentally today. Because we still have the highest incarceration rates. We still have high murder rates. We still have high disparities across the board that we're dealing with. So you about to say
something? And some of the most dangerous things about this type of trauma, this long duration trauma, is that the trauma starts to be accepted and then reinforced by your own community groups, which makes it even stronger. And there's something in particularly about the need for white acceptance.
Man, look, I was going to, you went there, let's go.
Yeah. No,
for real, because when we're talking about, when we start talking about an active lifestyle versus a sedentary lifestyle. So we've settled into a sedentary lifestyle to be more like master. We sat around all day and chill because the king, the boss, the CEO, the one in charge, the idea is they sit around all day. The fat cat sit around all day. We want to emulate that.
Well, I think one of the challenges we face is accepting the fact that a lot of our ideas about success in life stem from modeling white people. Right. And that's something we got to be real about. A lot of our ideas about how to achieve success stem from those same models of white people. A lot of the ways that we look at how to successfully manage a business, how to successfully manage work-life balance, what's the great neighborhood to live in, what schools to send your kids to, who do you want to be surrounded by, how do you want to speak? You know, I know that's a touchy subject with everybody, like, you know, they saying I talk white and I got bullied for doing this, doing that. But all of these things are centered around this idea of a comparison between white people. Even when we get on TV, we watch what we say. Code switching is a thing because white people will get uncomfortable if we talk around them the way we talk around each other. We acknowledge that, we accept it, and we, to some extent, celebrate each other for being able to do it.
Your news voice.
So, you know, but in these environments where white people are the standard, where they're being held up as the model to follow, it's really hard in those types of environments to think about progression in terms of anything that doesn't involve white people, which is where you come to a segment of the community that feels like we need white people to progress. We need white people to save us. You know what I'm saying?
And that got us stressed out. We really don't understand the stress that comes with trying to appease a group of people who've been terrorizing and dominating you and who really don't care for what you were trying to get from them or who care to appease your interest in anything like that. They don't care because they're in charge. Like they'll and like I was just thinking about going into white environments or forcing our way into white environments. Segregation, integration rather. Right?
And assimilation.
Yes. But the overall idea, because, you know, they push integration, even though it was really assimilation. But, you know, but we talk about it all the time. The parents who basically force their children to go to these schools and be terrorized by these white kids on a daily basis who were basically outnumbered and helpless. And they had to go through that and live with the scars of that for the rest of their lives for the sake of integrating into white schools. That trauma there is also passed down, but that's a reinforcement of what's already been happening 300-400 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've never had any point in time in American history to actually recover as a group of people, because even now, every year, the trauma is reinforced. Look at what happened with George Floyd. The trauma is reinforced. Somebody's killed a number of people are killed by the police a year that made a spectacle through the news. And it's like reinforcing the trauma, reinforcing the stress, reinforcing everything. And that takes a toll on our health. That's why our life expectancy is lower than any other group.
Absolutely. I think about W.B. Du Bois' double consciousness, because none of the things we're saying are new. You know, and there are constantly these arguments going around, arguments that are old. It's, you know, like old is the struggle itself. You know, and we're in a situation now where we need to be able to make changes and adjustment. But because, like you said, the trauma is reinforced so regularly, there isn't really time for us to do the necessary mental work. And so we even in this, I feel like one of the reasons we're so quick to just want to have fun and to unload the stress is because we're walking around with those burdens all day, every day. The only time we get to forget about them is when we're intoxicated, we're under the influence of some drug, or we're at some social event, just being able to have fun.
We want to have fun because we've always worked. We've always had to work. We've been America's number one labor class since America been America, before America been America. We've been the number one labor class. That ain't changing no time soon. We've said that plenty of times. So when you're saying that, that made me think about depending on the plantation the enslaved people were on, they may have gotten a Saturday and a Sunday off.
Right.
You working from sun up to sundown, Monday, let's say Monday through Saturday, you working sun up to sundown. Well, what you think they're going to do on Sunday when they free? They're going to party. They're going to drink. They're going to let loose and try to do their best to de-stress, even though the tools that they have to de-stress aren't healthy tools to de-stress, because they don't have the healthy tool to de-stress because they're enslaved. But that mentality, that psychology, the epigenetics was passed down to us. And now you're taking all that with the sedentary lifestyle, our health is horrible as a group. So let's move to poverty and racism, right? We know our health is bad, but let's look at some contributing factors to our, not just our, when I say overall health, not just physical, but our overall health, mental, physical, psychological, emotional, all that.
Mm-hmm.
We've always lived in poverty. We were a labor class, so we've always lived in poverty.
I just want to point this one thing out, because there are a lot of people that like to say all Black people aren't poor. And we're not saying that all Black people are poor. What you need to understand is that when we say that Black people are in poverty, we are saying that we are a disproportionate number of the people that live in poverty in America. Yes, there are some wealthy Black people. Yes, the majority of Black people are not in abstract poverty.
Right.
We understand that. But we are disproportionately represented in the poverty population. We are disproportionately represented in the lower income population. And this is another one of those comparative statements, right? There are Black rich and white rich are two different things.
Right. Jay-Z got, like, put it like this. I think last time, and I think numbers could have changed, but you know how we revere Oprah and her wealth?
Mm-hmm.
And Oprah's worth like $3 billion. There are at least 7 members of the Walton family in the top 15 wealthiest people in the world. 7 members in one family. Oprah, last time I checked, Oprah wasn't even in the top 200 wealthiest people in America.
Well, when you look at it, right, in the top 100 wealthiest people in America, there's what, less than 5 Black people?
Yeah.
And then if you blow that up to the top 300 or 400, the number doesn't increase that much. And we'll break it down on a real level, because that extreme wealth like that, most people are never going to see that. But when you're talking about like real wealth, the last time I looked at the numbers, if you made $66,000 or more a year, you were in the top 25% of Black income earners. To reach that same milestone in the white community, you needed to be making six figures. Like, so there's a distinct difference. We're not in abstract poverty, but we don't have the resources that that should be available to a group in America, the richest country in the history of the world. Go ahead.
And there's a why we don't have those resources. For one, we never had access to them, because mm-hmm. We were brought over here to be a labor class, and we were held and kept as a labor class. You had individuals who were able to come out and do things for themselves and their family, but the majority of Black people were enslaved in the labor class. And then we go to a time period after slavery where we have sharecropping. Now, when come Reconstruction, we had gains during Reconstruction, but what followed Reconstruction? Something by the name of the Jim Crow.
Black Jim Crow and the Black Codes.
Black Codes, redlining. But also, let's talk about the constant, because we always talk about Black Wall Street, right? But that's a significant point in this that will lead to and it explains the coupling of racism and poverty. So they're destroying Black economic centers. Black economic institutions are being systematically picked off and destroyed, because white people are jealous that Black people are doing better than them. Look at the good brother Christopher Everett's documentary, Wilmington on Fire. Right? That's one. Go learn about Rosewood. Go learn about, here in Tallahassee, they economically took out Frenchtown and Smoky Hollow. Like, now, every Black economic center was not specifically terrorized. A lot were. Some were systematically taken out. They got rid of those through means, underhanded deals, stealing people's lands and deeds and all those things. They're just taking advantage of people who were uneducated or undereducated. So all those things happened that led to the economic situation that we have. Because the idea is we as a whole of people mismanaged our money and just didn't do what we were supposed to do and was lazy. No, remember, it took a while for us to get to the point to where we don't trust each other and we don't work together. That's why economically we can spend $1 trillion today, but have nothing to show for it as a group. But remember, it took time to get us here. Integration, or really assimilation, was a huge economic hit to us because we gave up ours to be a part of theirs, which is another thing that really affected us economically.
Right. We're talking about white validation again. And the reason I bring up assimilation repeatedly anytime anybody starts talking about integration is because I've read a number of books from white historians talking about that period of time. And assimilation is the word that a lot of culturalists in their community use. The U.S. government had goals and plans to assimilate Black people, never to integrate. And those are two distinctly different words. For those of you that don't know the difference, when you assimilate something, right, you take that thing and you make it you. And then you bring yourself in the house. That's assimilation. Integration is you take that thing and you allow that thing to be what it is. And you make a space in your house for it. That never happened. And it was never in the plans for it to happen. Governments want their citizens, as diverse as they are, to assimilate. Right. Because an assimilated group is easier to govern, to control, to manage. It's easier to keep a handle on a bunch of people that think and act and feel alike and view the world the same way. That's the goal of every government. I don't care how progressive that government seems to be. That's why they push nationalism. That's one of the goals of nationalism, is to strip away all of those other things that make y'all different and give you this one thing that makes you the same. And we still see that today, where people are saying, I'm American. I'm not, you're not black. I'm not white. You're not this. You're not that. We're all American.
Somebody said that to me today.
Yeah. Like you're stripping away my heritage, my culture, my perspective, my worldviews and everything, because you want me to be like you.
I was watching something and it was like they've always pushed the idea of America being a melting pot, meaning you give up who you are and become who we want you to be.
Right.
That's how we got enslaved in the first place.
One.
And that was a big part of how they maintain the system of slavery, is when I convince you that your God isn't good enough, I convince you that your culture is less than mine, I convince you that your overall way of life is inferior to mine, and I convince you that I am what you need to survive. I am what you need to be liberated. I am what you need to be saved. Give up your God and come worship my God. Oh, and by the way, we're going to terrorize you. But in order to continue to do that, I need to get you to think the way I need you to think. Oh, yeah, we're going to reinforce that by whipping you and terrorizing you and raping you and all those different things. We're gonna do these things to make sure that you stay in line.
And even by being nice to you when it applies, when we need to be. Because there were a lot of slave masters that were nice. But here's the rub. Yeah, he's still a slave master. But and here's the other rub, right? Group psychology 101, right? You get two groups of people together, they might be able to maintain their identity and coexist, right? It's two groups, especially if they're equal power. What happens if you get two groups and one group has all of the resources and all of everything and the other group has nothing and is a servant class? Just presenting that dynamic begins to shift the psychology of everybody in both groups. The groups and the people in the group that has the resources, they feel superior. They have the resources.
Right. So, and just want to interject this. This is going into intergenerational cultural trauma.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
And the group that doesn't have the resources, they look up to and model the group that does have the resources. And it becomes a psychological game. And that is the game of assimilation. They will start to change themselves in order to gain validation, approval, and acceptance by the group that has the resources.
Right. So also, I want people to remember, because I'm in the process of writing my fourth book, On the Shoulders of Giants, Volume 4, The Caribbean, which will be out soon.
And I'm in the process of finishing my, I don't know what number book this is, Black Tactics of the Revolution. I think it's book number 5 for me. Or number 6. Fives.
So I don't know why I did.
It's like, what is that? Okay.
but looking at exactly what was happening with the terrorism and the psychology, because hey, we want y'all land. We heard y'all got gold. Yeah, so we want it. And that's just it. I mean, really, there's no way to try to sound smart with that. Like, really, that's what it was. It's like, hey, all right, the Portuguese got here first. They're like, hey, we want y'all stuff, so we gonna take it. And we heard about this dude named Preston John. Yeah, we want all y'all stuff. Oh, y'all got gold? Yeah, we taking y'all stuff. But also, learning that Columbus and his folk, and a lot of the Portuguese, Columbus, in an attempt to gain favor with the Portuguese crown, you know, they were selling up and down the coast. The Portuguese were selling up and down the west coast of Africa, terrorizing Africans since the early 1400s.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Not Columbus at that time, but the Portuguese were terrorizing the West African coast since the early 1400s. The culmination was 1492, Columbus and his attempt to get to the Indies, or get to India, specifically landed in the Caribbean, bumped into the people and was like, okay, yeah, we're going to take this. That buddy got a gold ring in his nose. He got a gold ring in it. We're going to take all y'all stuff. Killed them all, brought disease, all that stuff. Oh, yeah, because the concept of slavery and everything that they had going on, it's already been happening. They were already snatching Africans and taking them back to Portugal and enslaving them and using them, because they just like, oh, man, hey, look at these brown people. We can use them. They literally said the greatest capital they can get out of this is the human capital.
Well, because remember, they had been looking to try to enslave people for a while.
Right.
It just hadn't worked out with anybody.
They needed money. They were trying to revitalize their kingdoms.
So, you know, that's the thing. We're not saying that, and that's the other thing, right? It's not that white people invented slavery in America, but the form of slavery they utilized was different from any other form of history that slavery that had been in place.
Feudalism versus chattel slavery. So white people, Europeans, they practiced their savagery on each other forever. So by the time it got to them, 1492, and them deciding to go west, they perfected their savagery. And so that's what they inflicted on everybody who wasn't them. Remember, they did it to themselves first, and then they did it to us. But so you have the system of slavery, and then they coupled that with the idea of racism, and it really was solidified in the late 17, early to mid 1800s. Blumenbach, Linnaeus, people like that. From my research, Darwin wasn't necessarily a part of that, but they used his work to justify. Even though a Afro Arab man named Al Jahiz did the theory of species, or the evolution of the species, 1,000 years before Darwin, but I digressed. Go to On the Shoulders of James One, ontheshouldersone.com. You get that information. But so you create the idea of racism. The idea of racism is coupled with slavery, and racism is used to justify slavery and to justify chattel slavery, making someone a piece of property. So let me read this by Dr. Akbar. He says the animalistic treatment in slavery and the immense cruelty added up to the, well, this is a summary of Dr. Akbar's book. The animalistic treatment in slavery and the intense cruelty added up to the trauma and shock to African American. Added up to the communal and mental distress suffered by the people affected. One of the important points that Dr. Akbar made was about property. Slaves were not qualified to own things because they themselves are things. They only get to have necessary things that are needed to do their jobs and to live in a simple way. Slaves take orders from their masters, and this gap between them created more hatred and disgust that resulted in destruction of property and the usual torture and killing of disobedient slaves. The idea of you being reduced to a piece of property and then labeled nigga. So those have psychological effects. Think about it. We've got to a point to where we decided that we are going to try to take the sting out of the word nigga, but don't change the behavior, because we don't understand the behavior that goes into what a nigger is. Because I always say one of white America's greatest invention may have been the nigger.
Absolutely. I mean, I would agree with that. And that's, to me, that shows another sign of us trying to gain white acceptance. Instead of pushing back on the concept altogether, we embrace the term and the word.
Right.
Instead of getting to a place where we're not gonna partake in a lot of the systems they set up. We embrace them and then try to co-opt them to make them ours without doing anything to them to make it so that instead of them being damaging to the community, they're now beneficial for the community. So, and we see that today in music.
I call
all over the place.
I mean, we allow them to dictate the ideas of what black culture is, because black people who are not from the hood, not all of them, but a number of black people who are not from the hood believe that you have to act like you're from the hood to be authentic black.
Yeah, and my rub even with that is this idea of cool and swag. When you ask, and I've been asking a lot of people about this idea, and it ain't because I'm concerned about whether or not I have it, because I know that's usually the defense people have when we start having these conversations. Only motherfucker that ain't got no swag is worried about what swag is. The thing with that is the style of dress and the manner of speak. That when I talk to people and ask them, well, how do you define cool? How do you define swag? Especially you're saying black people are the originators of cool, the originators of swag. I said, well, what is that? The answers that I get usually are focused on a type of energy or a manner of behavior or speech or style of expression that is largely pushed from the lower income aspects of being black.
Right.
I don't really have no problem with that. But when you blow it up and start thinking about it on a larger scale, so everybody's idolizing the brokest of us. Everybody's idolizing right. those of us in the most destitute right. situations.
Right, right, right. So when I would have conversations with some parents and they would tell me, my kid is, or that child go through a phase where they're mad they're not poor and they don't live in the hood. I'm like, man, if I have children and my child ever say you mad, they mad because I done got us the way we need to be economically and we good. Oh, I'm finding the roughest hood and dropping you off.
I've been fortunate. I haven't heard that. But I tell my boys hood stories all the time. You know.
I mean, look, like we grew up in it, we work in it. Like it's not fun to struggle. It's not fun. Like a lot of us have been struggling for generations and generations and generations, and that's why we are here to this day saying, I'm here to break generational curses. I'm here to break generational traumas. I'm not fond of the term generational curses because we're not cursed people. We're traumatized people. We're terrorized right. people. We're people who were enslaved. It's not a curse. It's racism, white supremacy. That's what it is. Let's not minimize it. Let's not act like it ain't what it ain't. That's exactly what it is, because if that wasn't the case, we would be back in Africa doing something different.
Yeah, it's internalized as well, because what I've been, like, my thing of late is been trying to get people to understand that I don't care what color you are. If you weren't raised to believe that black people have value, you're biased against black people. That's American culture. And a lot of black people are biased against black people because they haven't been groomed to be anything else. And a failure to educate your black children, if you have a black child, to be proud of themselves, their culture, and their heritage, is to basically allow America to turn them into a weapon to be used against the community. It's to allow them to be turned into somebody that's biased against Black America. And that is one of the problems we have right now, is that so many of us are biased against ourselves. You hear it. And that this goes back again into the psychological need for validation from those in positions of power, aka white folk. You hear it all of the time when you listen to these people talking about how they're different. or how they, I ain't like regular black people. You know, with the girls, they call them the pick me's and whatever, right? Like, you know, it's the same thing with black people. I ain't like the rest of them. I'm different. You know, it was one of the first things they say after they say that. I went to school. As if black people ain't go to school.
Yeah, but it's like like I talked about last week when W.E.B. Du Bois talked about how long it took him to shake off the indoctrination he got from Harvard.
Yeah. Okay.
Going to college whitewashes us. Going to college prepares us to be workers in the white world. That's why our parents would always tell us you have to work twice as hard as a white person, because they were preparing us to work in a white world, to deal with, to basically, hey, go in these environments to be stressed out and traumatized some more. So the cultural intergenerational trauma continues.
And it wasn't just E.B. Du Bois. Dr. Blyden, the father of Pan-Africanism, said if you track his work, he went through a period where he had to shake off the indoctrination he went through when he was in school. I know when I went to college, it was a traumatizing experience being in a psychological program where the only time they recognized, and this is where I had to get training outside of school and take courses at other programs, because at the school that I originally signed up at, the only time they mentioned black culture was when they talked about countercultures. Black culture was a counterculture. It was a bad culture. It was a culture that provided no real benefit to American society. It was a culture that actually caused Americans to regress. And this class was taught by a white person that really didn't have much of an understanding of black culture or countercultures, apparently. But like that type of stuff, if you don't know any better, that'll stick with you and it'll fuck you up.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I guess I could say, think about it as of you having a underlying health condition that you may not have symptoms from. And then all of a sudden, everything happens. And now you're in the hospital and you were living with it. You just never knew it was because it wasn't bad. You really didn't have the effects like you thought you should have. But now it happens and you're here. See, with this, we have enough of us who have the resources to begin to understand, but I don't know how many of us actually want to understand what happened to us. Because I've said it for a while. I believe a number of us just want to find a comfortable place and just be left alone rather than to be able to change the system as a whole. So we could be healthy, live in a healthy environment and actually self-actualize.
But that's another sign of trauma.
Right.
Like you said earlier, we are a traumatized people.
Yes.
We are still very much deep within the throes of that trauma. We don't want, as a cultural group, we don't want to have to do the work necessary to change, because we are still experiencing fresh injections of trauma. We just want to be left alone right now.
Yeah.
Really. And when you talk to a lot of people, we really, as a community, from my dealings with the community, we really just want to be left alone right now, which is another sign of trauma.
Yeah.
It's like we're dealing with a community-wide depression.
So, right. So let's transition into terror management theory. So, the psychological importance of cultural worldviews is a central feature of TMT, terror management theory. From the perspective of TMT, cultural worldviews are an important reciprocity of value, cultural roles, identities, and standards of behavior, giving group members opportunities for deriving a sense of personal value. TMT further proposes that cultural worldviews have also evolved in part to assuage human anxiety about social isolation and existential anxiety. At the most fundamental level, cultural worldviews provide people with a sense of meaning and value, thereby assuaging essential anxiety. The corollary of this proposition is that cultural trauma, wherein a people have suffered a traumatic loss of meaning, identity, and value, will be associated with anxiety-laden thoughts and behaviors, ultimately leading to poor health and social outcomes. From this worldview, the psychological effects of PTSS, post-traumatic slave syndrome, would include a higher rate of existential anxiety, a lack of meaning, a fragmented identity, and compromised values. They said that, Dad. There it is. Like, that's us in a nutshell. That's how we're expressing ourselves right now, the best we know how, with all of this baggage that we're dealing with for all these generations, because we've been carrying this on our backs for generations and generations and generations. And we, like you say, we just want to be left alone and just live. But we can't, because it's like we're on a hamster wheel and we're stuck. Some of us see that we can get off, but the majority of us don't see that we can get off. And so we just rotating and rotating and rotating. And we don't realize we have the power to stop this wheel. But psychologically, because it's kind of like, you know, the little analogy they use. You take a baby elephant and you tie that baby elephant, you tie the rope to a pole. One end of the rope to a pole, the other end of the rope to the elephant's leg. And as a baby, the elephant tries to get off the rope, break the pole, but the elephant is a baby, so it's not strong enough. But over time, After failed attempt, the elephant psychologically internalizes that I cannot break this rope and this pole. I can't get away from this. The elephant grows up to be a massive, strong, powerful elephant who can just snap this pole whenever it wants to. But it's been conditioned to think that it can't break the pole. So it never tries to break loose because of the conditioning. That's where we are. We've been conditioned to believe this is where we have to be, and this is the only place we can be. But we can break the conditioning if we can get the information. And the problem is we're having a big issue, like really getting the information and really getting real cultural change, because you know we meeting real opposition, and whites and racism, white supremacy is a hell of an opponent. Now we can defeat them motherfuckers, but we got to get our shit together.
Maybe we can, maybe we can't. But if we don't get into a place where we can at least try, it doesn't matter.
We got to try, but we got to recognize what has happened to us. Like, I am so thankful for FAMU psychology program, because like, when I graduated college, going back to what you're talking about earlier about a lot of us coming out of college and not really, and our minds being scrambled. My mind wasn't scrambled because of FAMU psychology program. I came out of FAMU psychology program, a critical thinker and somebody who has an understanding, not a full understanding, but somebody with a foundation and a baseline understanding of what has happened to us, because I was taught by master teachers who were taught by our master teachers. So shout out to FAMU psychology program. Again, so PTSS, tell them what PTSS is.
Post-traumatic slave syndrome. That's what PTSS is.
And I break it down for them.
It's like, well, I was going to be silly. Post-traumatic slave system is something that was coined and popularized by Dr. Joy DeGruy. And it's basically a worldview that looks at slavery as the cause of a lot of the ills in the community, and says that we're still basically suffering from the trauma that was imposed on us through slavery. That's about as simple as I can make it.
It's just think about what we talked about last week about PTSD. That's it. PTSD, intergenerational PTSD due to slavery. That's what we're dealing with right now. And if you and we need, that's why we need our professionals to come in and be able to help us rather than us trying to self-diagnose and self-heal. Like, that's what we get into, us coming together and healing together and but being able to put egos aside, and we know we got all the unity issues and we're explaining why we have those issues now, but being able to, those of us who light bulbs coming on and you're learning new things, you're growing, as we grow and we know better, we do better. That's why I want us to get, like, continue to grow. Because if we continue to grow, then we're going to get new ideas, new concepts, new values. And with these new ideas, concepts, and values, we will look at ourselves better and we'll look at each other different. Look at each other better. Like I was telling a guy the other day, one of the reasons why I'm such a big, I push learning African history so much, because personally, I know what it did for myself. I know what it did for me, and I know what it did for a lot of people around me. It made me really love myself better. When I really understood, like, okay, we're more than what they tell us, it made me feel good to be a Black person. It made me feel good to be a person of African descent. It made me love my skin tone, love my melanin, love my features. To understand that our features are the features that are considered, that are the standard. We are really the standard. They are trying to be like us. But in our psychological state, or our psychological enslaved state, still mentally, because we are still looking for white acceptance and we want to be like them, we look at them as the standard, even though they're looking at us as the standard. Get Dr. Naeem Akbar's book, Breaking the Chains of Psychological Slavery. Great book. Get Dr. Francis Cross Welsin's The ISIS Papers. Get that. Get Dr. Amos Wilson books. Like, get the books. Because they're going to help give a perspective on what happened to us psychologically. Because we have to understand what happened to us psychologically. I was fortunate enough to take a class that was literally titled The Psychology of Racism and Prejudice. Learned a lot. Our mental state will determine when we become free. And that's all I got to say about that. Hey, man, let's take care of ourselves, take care of our health, take care of our minds, our bodies, our souls. Let's do better, feel better, live better. And let's win as a whole. Let's win and love each other. You hear me? Freedom Train Podcast Series. Y'all stank.